Hey everyone, this is Josh, host of the Urban Valor Podcast. Today's guest is Army veteran Michael Cook. Michael grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan playing hockey and played for Eastern Michigan University. He enlisted in the Army because he loved being part of a team. Michael deployed to Afghanistan in 2019 where he met two Afghans, Abdul and Muhammad, who he became great friends with. Eventually, after Michael had to leave Afghanistan, Abdul and Muhammad found themselves facing life or death amid the chaotic Afghanistan evacuation. Determined to rescue Abdul, Muhammad, and their families, Michael spearheaded a rescue mission with an underground network working to save our allies. If you enjoy this episode, go give us a 5-star rating and leave a comment to help support our veterans. The bigger the community, the bigger the impact. If you'd like to contribute your story to Urban Valor or know anyone else who may, reach out on Instagram at Urban Valor TV, or you could email me at josh@urbanvalor.com. Enjoy the show.
Yeah, hey, I'm Michael Cook. Spent 6 years in the Army from 2017 until last October. Was a 12 whiskey engineer the entire time, serving the reserves out of Ohio. Got out as a E6 staff sergeant after 6 years. So I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is a very liberal city. You know, had a very normal childhood upbringing. Everyone in Michigan plays hockey. I obviously grew up playing hockey and, you know, being involved in team sports my whole life. Went to Eastern Michigan University, continued to play hockey for the club program out there. One of the reasons I went there is I wanted to continue playing hockey at whatever level I could. Graduated from Eastern Michigan University in 2011. And then I packed up my bags and headed west and moved out to the beach in California and ended up being there for 5 years. When I moved west, I moved to Huntington Beach, lived there for a while, lived in Newport Beach for a while. First couple years out there were great. I wasn't, you know, overly concerned about being a part of a team anymore. I was kind of in that honeymoon phase of no longer playing hockey and just enjoying like living on the beach, right? After a couple years, like I felt like something was missing all of a sudden. Like I was no longer a part of a bigger organization than myself. I was no longer a part of the team. And I think that was one of the reasons why I really started thinking about joining the Army or the military in general. You know, it's like growing up in a liberal city, joining the military is not something that's usually on your radar. I didn't have any friends that were going into the service. I didn't have any family history except for my great-great-grandfather served in the Civil War. He's from Pennsylvania, so he fought for the Union Army and actually got captured and was a POW for 2 years in a Confederate camp and lost his leg in the camp and all this crazy stuff. So from him until me, there was nobody that was serving. So, you know, the military was something that was kind of always in the back of my mind, but never really felt like something that was attainable or something that I was ever going to do with my life. And so I picked up with a recruiter in Huntington Beach. I actually wanted to join the Marine Corps initially, but the Marine Corps wanted me to start, I think, as an E2, where the Army said that I could start as an E4 because I had my college degree already. That kind of made my decision easy to, you know, not go to the Marines anymore and join the Army. I went to basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia in 2017, I think February. You know, my experience was a little different than most because I turned 27 when I was at basic trainings. You know, you're going through basic with a bunch of 18, 19-year-old kids, and here I am turning 27. It was the worst birthday of my life. You know, I think the drill sergeants, you know, kind of realized that I was a bit older and maybe a little more mature and kind of left me alone for the most part. I remember when I first got there, I think like the first or second day, one of the drill sergeants came up to me and asked how old I was, and I told him, you know, I'm about to turn 27. And his first response was like, where the fuck were you 5 years ago when we were fighting the war? And I'm just like, oh shit, like this is gonna be tough. But you know, like just like anybody else, you just put your head down and just get through the 10 weeks and come out on the other end. We had a drill sergeant named Drill Sergeant Tsunami. He was from the Pacific Islands and was just, you know, completely out of his mind. One night he comes into the bay and he makes us dump our camel packs over our heads. And then he goes in the latrine and starts turning all the sinks and showers on and clogs them all up and floods the bay. So we start like the beginning of what ends up being a 4-hour smoke session. By like, you know, hour two, maybe hour three, like the bay was like starting to fill up with water from it flooding. I'll never forget this. He's standing in the middle of the bay with like this big staff and he's just banging it on the ground and he's yelling out, backstroke. And then we all start doing the backstroke around the bay. And then he's like, breaststroke. And we start, like, it was comical. Like at the time, we thought it was crazy. Now, like looking back on it, and when I do talk to my basic training buddies, we all laugh about that story. I felt like I just like, you know, blanked that time period out in my life. It was just like a turn your brain off and just get through it. I hated it. It sucked. I mean, I don't think anybody ever has a good experience going to basic training, right? You just have to get through it. So I think I just put my blinders on and, you know, did what I had to do and to get out of there. I enlisted as a 12 whiskey engineer. So I started as an E4 specialist in the Army. I went to Fort Benning, Georgia. After the 10 weeks of basic training in the Army, you go to your advanced individual training, AIT. So my AIT was in Gulfport, Mississippi, with the Navy Seabees. It was a Navy base. So the Navy engineers, the Air Force engineers, and the Army engineers all went to Gulfport together for our engineering school. So I was there for 7 weeks. And then once you complete that, then you just, you know, if you're in the reserves, you just go back to your normal life, except for your weekend drills. So went back to Michigan, got put into 486 Engineer Company out of Toledo, Ohio. So it was about an hour drive from my house, you know, for the next 2 years before I deployed. Just did the reserve thing, the, you know, 1 weekend a month, like, you know, 2-3 weeks out in the woods in the summer, but very easy. We didn't know exactly where we were going, but we got orders to deploy in 2019. You know, we knew we were going to Kuwait to start, and then we'd get pushed out somewhere else, but we didn't know where that was going to be. You know, everyone has a preference, I think, of where they want to go, especially the guys that have deployed before. This was my first deployment. So, you know, a lot of guys wanted to go to Iraq. Some guys wanted to go to Syria. Some guys wanted to just, you know, chill in Kuwait and, you know, eat Pizza Hut for a year and do nothing. I really wanted to go to Afghanistan, even from a young age, just like, you know, watching the news of the war in Afghanistan, watching even like Army and Marine Corps commercials and stuff. I was always very intrigued by the Afghan culture, the people, the landscape, and I just wanted to see it and see what life would be like living in Afghanistan. So we get to Kuwait. We're there for about 2 weeks and we still don't know where we're going. There was rumors that we were going to get stuck in Kuwait the whole time. And then eventually I remember we're sitting in the bay and my platoon sergeant comes in and says, we got orders to Afghanistan and we're, you know, leaving tomorrow or the next day. And everyone was pumped, you know, because that fear of being stuck in Kuwait in the million degree heat for a year is, you know, enough to, you know, be very excited when you get a chance to get out of there. And I think I probably felt a small amount of fear, maybe just from the unknown. Not, you know, I wasn't a combat MOS, so I wasn't like worried about going out on patrols and getting shot, but just the uncertainty of, you know, where you're going and what was going to happen. Yeah. After 2 weeks in Kuwait, we fly into Bagram in Afghanistan, where everyone pretty much flies into. We were there for 2 to 3 days, I think. I remember our first night there, as soon as we got there's a Black Hawk, or I think an Apache, crashed right off base and the pilots died. So I was like, shit, like, you know, this is our day one here and they have an Apache crash. Got orders to go up to Mazar Sharif, which is a city in the north, which is the city, if you've seen the movie 12 Strong, the horse soldiers when they first entered Afghanistan with the Northern Alliance, that's Mazar Sharif. That was the city that they were taking over. So I was on Camp Marmal, which is a NATO German-run base. We had a pretty small contingency of U.S. troops. So it was just my platoon of engineers. There was an Army ODA team, some other support staff, but that was it. And then it was just a bunch of foreign troops. So a ton of Germans, Swedes, Mongolians, I mean, people from Croatia, everywhere. Which was pretty cool just to be able to interact with, you know, the other troops from other countries. I remember just like looking out at these mountains. I think it's called the Tangi Pass, and that's where the horse soldiers came through in that movie 12 Strong, and, the, you know, obviously a true story. And I remember just spending a lot of time just staring at that pass and those mountains, and it was just so like jagged and treacherous, but also just insanely beautiful. And I just thought about how wild it must have been to ride horses through that pass while fighting the Taliban. Is so crazy. But that's really where my book starts, because there at Camp Marmal, I meet my friends Abdul and Mohammed, who are Afghan nationals, who are contractors and our allies. More importantly than, I think, being a coworker or an ally, we became friends. Spent, you know, almost every single day with them. They would bring us home-cooked meals from their wives, you know, whatever we needed, they would get for us, and didn't ask for anything in return. You know, that's just the Afghan culture. The Afghan people are some of the most hospitable people in the world. A lot of people don't know that, where they'll give you the shirt right off their back. If you walk into an Afghan household, you're going to be treated like royalty 100% of the time. I would describe Abdul and Mohammed as very humble. Like I said, they don't ask for much, but they give everything. And they're family men. They both have wives. Mohammed has 4 kids now. His newborn baby was actually born in the U.S. since they've been here, and she's an American citizen, which is very cool. Abdul has 2 kids. They just want You know, like any what any American wants, they want a future and a safe place to raise their kids. Afghanistan is not that place for a U.S. ally, especially after we left them all behind. So amazing human beings, proud to call them friends. The majority of the Afghans were happy that U.S. troops were in Afghanistan. The majority of people, the population there, does not support the Taliban. They want their daughters to be able to grow up and go to school. They want their daughters to grow up and have a job. They don't want, you know, this Taliban regime to, you know, impede on their lives. You know, the Doha talks were going on while we were in Afghanistan. So we could, you know, we were some of the last waves of troops to enter the country. I remember realizing that we were going to be pull out of Afghanistan. And the Afghan nationals that were there, I remember one of my buddies, his name was Habibi. He comes running up to me when he figures this out. And he's like, you guys, are you leaving? Like, you can't leave. You need to stay here and protect us. If you leave, we're all going to get slaughtered. You know, he said something along the lines of that, like as if I had any control about U.S. Forces leaving Afghanistan. You know, I didn't really know what to say to that. I was like, well, yeah, dude, I'm leaving. I don't know what's going to happen after we leave, because at that point, it still wasn't clear. But yeah, they wanted us to be there to support them, to protect them from the Taliban, and they did not want us to leave. After several months of being in Mazar Sharif, my platoon got orders to go south to Camp Moorhead, which is a little south of Kabul, which was just a small special forces camp. Again, very small contingency was of U.S. troops. It was just my platoon. There's a platoon of 10th Mountain there, and then an ODA team. And then that was really it. That was the base where Afghan National Army trains their commandos. So a lot of the ODA team and the support staff that are there pretty much spend all their time just training up the commando force for the Afghans. Wrote out my deployment there. You know, anytime you're on like a special forces camp, it's great because, you know, there's not really a dress code. You walk around in hoodies, food's good. We get into beginning of 2020 now and COVID hits and I'm still in Afghanistan, which was interesting. I'm at Camp Moorhead and it's 2020 and COVID starts hitting back home and we're all watching the news and reading articles, just trying to figure out what the hell was going on back here. We had a pretty good quarantine situation because we're just dug into the side of a mountain at Camp Moorhead and it's very few people on base. So I don't think we had any cases that I knew of while we were there, but getting home was a shit show because we had to quarantine in Kuwait for a month. Horrible because there was nothing to do. Everything was closed. It was, you know, 125 degrees outside. Then we fly back to the U.S. We have to quarantine out in New Mexico for an additional 14 days. Again, you're just pretty much a prisoner. Can't really leave your barracks. So then got home summer of 2020 and just, you know, went back to my reserve life. I stayed in touch with Abdul Muhammad through WhatsApp. I remember going to say bye to them when I got orders to leave Camp Marmal. And, you know, we gave them a hug and shook their hands. I made a joke like, hey, you should come see me in Michigan sometime, you know. But, you know, then we shook hands and it was with the understanding that we are never going to see each other again. Fast forward to summer of 2021. I'm at my best friend's wedding. I'm the best man in the wedding. I'm trying my best to be focused on his day and having fun. But I'm, you know, constantly checking the news because at this point, you know, it's mid-August and the Taliban has closing in on Kabul. You know, they took Mazar Sharif. They took a lot of those exterior villages and towns pretty easily. And now they're kind of on the doorstep of Kabul. That alone was just such a major intelligence failure on the U.S. government, because there's different reports from different entities, intelligence entities, based on timelines of Taliban activity. Some said that the Taliban would never take Kabul. Some said that it would take them at least 12 months to take Kabul. None of them said it was going to take 5 days to take Kabul. At this point, Abdul Muhammad had fled down to Kabul from Mazar Sharif because it was the last remaining safe city that the Afghan national government still had control over. And I remember getting a call the day after my best friend's wedding from Abdul, and he's holding his daughter. We're FaceTiming, so I can see him. I can see his daughter, who at this time is like maybe one or two. I've told this story a lot of times, and it just never gets easier. That my mother is standing next to me while we're FaceTiming, and she's, you know, looking at Abdul's daughter, and it's starting to click with my mother that this little girl, her future is about to be ripped out from under her, and she doesn't even know it. You know, she's going to grow up in Afghanistan like every other female there, and she's not going to be able to go to school. She's not going to be able to have a job. She's not going to be able to leave the house without a male escort or without her face covered. She was not going to be able to vote or have any sort of rights at all. And I remember my mom having to step off screen because she got so emotional. Abdul starts asking me, you know, is there a way that we can get out of here? Is there a way you can help us? And at that point, you know, I knew nothing about the special immigrant visa program. I knew nothing about the digital Dunkirk network of veterans that was already underway at that point of, you know, all these veterans that saw this tremendous failure on behalf of the U.S. government, not living up to our promise to our allies to evacuate them. They were sick of it. And instead of just sitting on the sidelines, all these veterans stepped up and created all these, you know, group chats and message threads on WhatsApp and Signal and even Instagram. And, you know, we're essentially creating these joint operation centers online and passing information. And I told him I would, you know, look into these visas to see if there's, you know, anything that could be done. He had already started the process of looking into the special immigrant visa program. And one of the very first steps of that program is you have to get a recommendation letter, an HR recommendation letter from your direct supervisor that you worked for while you were serving the U.S. government. And then just going through the rest of this list of items that they had to do, I've told this to a bunch of people because it's just so crazy. As an American English speaker, this whole list of paperwork they had to fill out was difficult. You know, as an Afghan who maybe speaks a little English, but probably almost certainly doesn't read or write in English and may not even read and write in their own language, right? Because that's not very common. It was impossible. So it was the program was just completely broken and it's still 2 years later broken and they haven't done anything to fix it. So we start chasing this HR recommendation letter from Abdul Muhammad's direct supervisor, quickly find out who he is. I get his email. I send him an email explaining who I was, what I was trying to do, that we're looking for a recommendation letter for Abdul Muhammad. He knew who they were. He didn't respond the first day. I reach out to him again, send him another email, just following up. And then I get an email back from him. I talk about him in my book, but I don't use his real name because it was the most gutless thing that any human being has ever said to me. And he said, I don't remember the exact quote, but something along the lines of, I don't think I can help because I'm worried about what this might do to my security clearance in my career. I remember reading that in just disbelief. Like, this dude was trying to put his security clearance and his career over the lives of people who were, you know, being threatened. You know, throughout that whole evacuation and the whole digital Dunkirk network, we saw people stepping up constantly and, you know, putting their ranks on the line to do the right thing. So to see this guy do the opposite of that just made me infuriated. And as I'm reading this response, Abdul messages me on WhatsApp and just asks if I heard from this guy. And I just told him, no, I haven't heard back because I didn't want to tell him that we were dead in the water already. Out of nowhere, the next day, Abdul sends me a completed HR recommendation letter. He had contacted the mayor of Camp Marmal and got him to write him one, which was amazing. So at this point, you know, we have a little momentum. And I'm like, okay, I feel like the first step I need to do is to reach out to my state senator. So I reach out to Senator Debbie Stabenow and her staff, who were amazing to work with. They weren't really put in a position to help. I know they wanted to. They tried their best to help. I asked them to expedite Mohammed and Abdul's special immigrant visas. They said they were going to try everything they could, but the guidance they were getting from the State Department was to tell us to have Abdul and Mohammed shelter in their homes until they get called to go to the airport. Fast forward to today, they still don't even have special immigrant visa case numbers. So they would still be sitting in their house waiting for that phone call, and it was never going to come, and it hasn't come for the majority of people that applied for this program. At this point, we had already left, U.S. troops have already left Bagram, which is another just complete shit show and horrible mistake. And the evacuation was being run out of HKIA, Hamid Karzai International Airport, which is a civilian airport. So very little security versus Bagram, which has excellent security. One runway versus Bagram that has multiple runways. It made no sense as to why we were running the evacuation out of there and instead of, you know, holding on to Bagram instead of passing it over to the Afghan National Army. And I remember at that point just kind of like doing the math as to how many people were trying to get out, how many days we had left, before the U.S. were pulling out, and how many, like roughly how many flights might be getting in and out. And the, like, it was very clear to me immediately that nobody was coming for them, right? Nobody's coming for my friends, Abdul Mohammed. And if they're going to get out, I got to figure out a way somehow to get them into the airport and onto a flight. Talk to them. I'm like, hey, I think we just need to make a run for the airport and just see what happens. So they gather up their family. So their wives, they're at this point, five children, all of them under eight. One of them was a newborn baby, just a few, like a few months old. They make a run for the airport. You know, the U.S. troops had control of the gates at the airport, but the Taliban had exterior perimeter control. To get up close to a gate, there's a strong chance you were going to have to go through a Taliban checkpoint. And to get into the gate, you had to have U.S. paperwork, right? Those are the two things don't add up very well. If you get caught as an Afghan by the Taliban and you have U.S. credentials, high likelihood you're going to get executed on the spot. And many people did. The rules of engagement for our troops on the ground there didn't allow them to intervene with anything. And a lot of the Marines I interviewed were just watching people get shot point blank for no reason at all. And there was nothing that they could do about it. So on their first attempt at the airport, Mohammed gets grabbed by the Taliban and he gets beat pretty senselessly. They were hitting him with their rifles. When I saw him a few months later, he was still covered from head to toe in bruises. I mean, he got his ass beat real good. Luckily, he was able to, you know, get away and sneak into the crowd, and they didn't chase him. So that whole first day, they spent about 12 hours just trying to get through Abbey Gate. You know, anybody that's seen the pictures of the videos know that it was just like packed. I mean, you couldn't move. It was hot. People were getting trampled. Again, a lot of the Marines I interviewed just were watching people fall, get stepped on, and never got back up. Babies were getting trampled. People were so desperate that mothers were trying to throw their babies over the, you know, 12-foot T-walls. Babies were getting stuck in the Constantine wire and just bleeding out. I mean, this, the level of desperation was just insane. I wasn't even there, you know, but you could tell just from the videos, that it was just an absolute shit show. You know, after Afghans stormed the airport the first time, we saw videos of the C-17s taking off and people are holding on to the wheel wells, right? And I remember watching this video of these Afghans just holding on and the plane takes off. And then you just see these bodies start falling from thousands of feet in the air. And just instantly, I went back to 9/11, right? And just watching bodies fall from the sky and hitting pavement. And it just hit me as like the war is ending the exact same way it started. Crazy for 20 years later for it to be happening like that. Back to Abbey Gate, Abdul Mohammed, their families spent, you know, 12, 14 hours there the first day. They're fighting their way to the front. They're standing, you know, knee waist deep in shit water, real shit water with babies. You know, it's not a good combination. And U.S. troops were using jammers to, you know, try to reduce the threat of an IED or a suicide vest or some, you know, any type of explosion. But that cut out phone lines. So it was very difficult to communicate him once he, you know, got into Abbey Gate. So anytime we wanted to communicate, he would have to pull back and lose all his progress. Now, eventually, I remember I get a call from Abdul probably after 15, 16 hours of the first attempt. And he just says, brother, can I take this time to go home and hug my family? And, you know, I just like immediately started getting emotional. I think that was one of the times where the, you know, the consequences of what was happening were really adding up. And I could hear a little bit of, not resentment, but disappointment in his voice because, you know, they made it all the way up to probably 15 feet away from Marines at Abbey Gate. And here I am, I'm a non-commissioned officer in the U.S. military. So to Abdul, he can't figure out why I can't get him in when he's 15 feet from them, you know? So there was a lot of disappointment and I was like, brother, I'm gonna try my best. I'm gonna, you know, figure out a way to get you in there. And he just says, I know you will, brother. I will wait. And, so they go home because they got to get the kids, you know, water. They got to feed the kids. They go back to the house that they're hiding in Kabul. And that's when I realized, like, I need to do better. I need to figure out a better way to do this. We can't just make senseless runs for the airport. And at that point, the Taliban had come out and said that Afghans had 12 more hours to leave the country before they were going to shut the gates from the outside. And no one else was going to be able to leave. Because obviously, you know, the Taliban is the new government. They want to make sure that infrastructure is still going to be able to run. So they don't want their doctors leaving. They don't want their, you know, people running infrastructure to leave. So they're going to be doing everything they can to keep people in Afghanistan. That was the point where I turned to the internet and realized that there was this group that wasn't, you know, not necessarily organized, but just all these veterans and even civilians and congressional staffers and people in the CIA and all these different intelligence agencies were collecting on these platforms online and on these message threads through Signal and WhatsApp. And, you know, individually, we had very little information. Like for me, you know, all I had was the names of Abdul Muhammad. That's all I was bringing to the table. But collectively, we realized we had a ton of information that we could pass. So passing information on what units were working, what gates. So I could, you could find out that 2-1 was working Abbey Gate. And hey, here's a list of phone numbers of dudes in 2-1 that are at Abbey Gate right now. Passing maps of ways to get to the airport without hitting Taliban checkpoints, passing information on what documents the State Department was accepting at that time, which was another complete clusterfuck because interviewing the Marines, they said that the information coming from the State Department was always changing the entire time they were there. So at one point, you know, X amount of documents was good. The next moment, that wasn't good anymore. Then it was good again. They said that the State Department was working like normal 9-to-5 business hours, and they never even saw them come to the gate. Like, it's just pathetic. If that's all true, and it sounds like it is. Met some just amazing people in these chats that really wanted to help. Chris Davis is a big one, who he actually wrote the foreword for my book. He's a Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel now. He was communicating with some Marines inside the gate, and so we kind of created a plan together to get these two families to meet up. My family's and one of his families meet up, and then we're going to get him in the gate. I tell Abdul Muhammad, hey, we need to make another run for the airport because the Taliban's going to close off these gates from the outside in 12 hours. So it's now or never. They make another run for the airport. At this point, I have a map, potential route that will get them there without hitting any checkpoints. They take it. They don't hit any checkpoints. So I go back on the, you know, message thread right away and tell people like this route worked and we didn't have any issues. Had Abdul do a little like challenge and password on cardboard. So he wrote the words Marmal. And was holding it up, and that was the base that we had met at. So I told, you know, my Marine contact that he was going to be holding that, and he was going to be holding a white handkerchief, I think, or a purple handkerchief, I forget. Abdul is like, whenever he can get a text through at Abbey Gate, he's sending me a picture of his location. You know, he keeps taking pictures 360 so I can see exactly where he is. The other family's doing the same thing, so we're, you know, we can get them as close together as possible before bringing them in. I remember at one point I lose contact with him and I get a phone call from him all of a sudden. And like I said, the jammers were going. So like any phone call you could get through was so valuable because you didn't know how long it was going to last. And so he calls me, he's like, brother, I made it into the airport. And I'm like, oh, we're done. Like this is great. Didn't hear from him for about an hour or two. And then I get another call from him and he's outside the airport again. And he had been, the Marines had pulled him in, but State Department kicked him out because he had an application filed for a special immigrant visa, but didn't actually have a special immigrant visa given to him, which again, 2 years later, he still wouldn't have had. Real long story short, it's just a shit show at Abbey Gate. And I'm just trying to encourage them to stay as long as they can and just keep trying. You know, at this point, it's like the 25th, I think, the day that the bomb exploded. And, you know, I guess going back to, just the failures of U.S. intelligence. You know, when we left Bagram and handed it over, on Bagram is the Parwan detention facility, which is the prison that we keep ISIS, we keep Taliban, Al-Qaeda, everybody in, right? When we handed Bagram over to the ANA, the Afghan National Army, in a botched handoff, all those prisoners escaped. It turns out that the ISIS-K member that was tasked with the suicide bombing at Abbey Gate was somebody that we had in that prison and we let go. Through somebody's intelligence, information was getting passed as to what this guy was wearing, how old he was. So he was supposed to be a young guy wearing dark clothing and he was going to be escorted by an older gentleman. I forget what they said he was wearing, but this information even made it on our digital Dunkirk chat room. So I was getting messages that morning, the 25th, saying, hey, suicide vest en route to Abbey Gate, time now. And so everyone knew it was coming. We knew it was coming. Everyone on the ground said they knew it was coming. They were getting intelligence. Sergeant Vargas Andrews is one of the snipers from 2-1 Weapons Company. He identified two individuals that met that description. He called in for, I think, like psychological operations officers to come in and verify that this was the individual that they were talking about and briefing everyone on. They confirmed they thought this was the suicide bomber. Sergeant Vargas then calls in his battalion commander to give him authorization to, you know, eliminate the threat. And the battalion commander says, I don't have that authority and I don't know who does, which doesn't make any sense, right? You're the battalion commander of a Marine Corps infantry battalion in Afghanistan. And how do you not know if you have the ability to give your troops permission to fire? And how do you not know who does? So just a complete failure. To this day, Sergeant Vargas believes that that was the suicide bomber that he had in his scope, and he could have eliminated the threat and saved his friends, because he lost friends. You know, he lost an arm, he lost a leg, and he lost his friends when there was an opportunity to potentially save everybody. You know, a few hours before the bombing, and I get a call again from Abdul. And but this time, like, I could hear him, but I could tell that the phone wasn't to his ear. You know, I could hear him yelling, and I could, at first I thought the worst, because I could hear him screaming like bloody murder. And I was like, fuck, so like, does the Taliban have him? What's going on? And then I can make out the words that he's saying. He's screaming, talk to the sergeant, meaning talk to me. And he, you know, the way his voice sounded, I could tell he had his phone extended in his hand. Then the next voice I hear was Sergeant Zelensky, United States Marine Corps. And I'm just like, fuck yeah. Okay, I'm on the phone with a Marine who's there. So quickly identify myself, identify Abdul Muhammad. So these guys worked with us, they're allies. They have special immigrant visas pending. At this point, I had them manifested on a Save Our Allies flight. So Nick Pomishano, Tim Kennedy, Chad Robichaud, awesome dudes that were, you know, pretty much acting as civilians, flying planes in and taking people out. So I talked to Nick Pomishano, and he got Abdul Muhammad manifested on one of their flights that was about to come in. So that helped. So I was like, he's manifested on flight so-and-so. Actually, at first, Zelensky thought, the way I identified myself, he thought I was there because the Army was there as well. I asked him if he could escort them down to State Department. He said, I don't have any resources. Can you come down here and grab them yourselves? I'm like, brother, I'm stateside. Like, can you? And I just like started begging him, and he, and you know, he could hear, I'm sure, the desperation in my voice. And he said, absolutely, brother, I'm going to help you. I'm going to get them in safely. And he did. I lose communication with them for 2 or 3 hours. And then I get a text message from Abdul, and it's just a picture of his State Department bracelet. And then he sends me a selfie of both families all wearing State Department bracelets. And that meant that they made it in. They made it through State Department and they were safe. They're about to get on a flight. And that was just like one of the best moments of my whole life. And I remember I went up to my bedroom and I just threw both my fists in the air. And I'm just standing there by myself and clapping and just crying and just so happy. They flew to Qatar, and then they flew to Germany, and then they flew to DC, and then they flew to Indiana. So it was several months before they got released to me. So they got released Halloween day of 2021, which was so special because my whole hockey team had donated me a bunch of costumes for the kids. So the first thing they did as Americans was to go out and go trick-or-treating. And it was so mind-boggling to them, even to Abdul and Muhammad and their wives. They just like couldn't believe, like, they never seen costumes like this. So like, what the hell is going on? But just to watch the kids sprint around with smiles on their face and just knowing they were safe was like, again, just the greatest thing of my entire life. When I talked to Zelensky on the phone during that whole situation, you know, it was such a shit show there, and there's so much commotion, and my adrenaline was pumping that I thought he said Sergeant Zelensky with a V. So I immediately wrote down Sergeant Zelensky because I figured that information would be useful at some point. And so I spent the next, you know, year and a half looking for a Sergeant Zelensky in the Marine Corps and can't find one. Eventually, through Northern Provisions Instagram page, figured out his name was Sergeant Zelensky through one of his buddies. And 10 minutes later, I'm on the phone call again with Zelensky, but this time we're both calm. We're both in the United States. We can just have a casual conversation. And we talked for an hour, and we both just, you know, sat there and cried on the phone. And he was just so happy to hear that they were here and safe, because those guys, I mean, they got put through, you know, the worst month of their lives and just saw so many bad things that people shouldn't have to see. So for him to see something good that comes out of this was incredibly important to him. And I know it means the world to him. So he flew up to Michigan with his dad. You know, I met him for a beer first and gave him a big hug. And then we went over to Abdul and Muhammad's place for an Afghan dinner. And it was one of the greatest things I've ever seen, getting to watch Zelensky with the kids. And just for him to be sitting at that dinner table with this family of, you know, multiple generations that he saved was nothing short of spectacular. And, you know, I remember watching Zelensky's dad who was there, who, you know, I've said this before, I don't think I've ever seen a more proud dad than watching his dad watch his son share dinner with two families that, of whose lives he saved. So that was really special to me. I'm very thankful that, you know, I get to see Abdul Muhammad all the time. They live just 30 minutes from me, and they're doing great. And the kids have futures again. The daughter is going to grow up, and they're already speaking fluent English, which is crazy after just 2 years. But they're going to get to grow up and go to school, and they play soccer, and they can have jobs. And we're just, you know, we're so lucky that they were able to get out, because a lot of people didn't. A lot of people got left behind and are still there. And it's a travesty, because we made a promise to these Afghan partners that if they stood by us for 20 years of war, we were going to have their backs if anything happened. And that's a promise that we failed to keep. And a lot of them are being slaughtered daily today because of it. Abdul and Muhammad are adjusting pretty well. It's a challenge for sure, because it is night and day different. You know, it's completely different country, completely different customs, just stuff that you don't even like think about. I remember when they first got here and we had them in a hotel, and we had to like an extended stay hotel. So it had like an oven range, and we had to, you know, explain to them how to turn the oven on, and, you know, how to use the microwave. And just like, there's a million small things like that, that you just don't even realize that don't exist everywhere in the world. Abdul and Muhammad came speaking English pretty well. So they're, you know, a lot better off than a lot of people that came over. A lot of people came over and couldn't speak any English at all. And they're going to, unfortunately, have a very difficult time, I think. The kids have picked up English great. The women are learning English pretty great, while they both have jobs and apartments. And like I said, Muhammad had a newborn baby who's an American citizen, which is, you know, super cool. You know, there was a DOD report that came out talking about the incident at Abbey Gate, and a lot of my book kind of dives into the differences, I guess, between what the DOD report says and what boots on the ground say happened. You know, for one example is the DOD report says that it was not a complex attack, and there was no small arms fire after the explosion. Well, I can tell you every single Marine that I've talked to that was there said they were getting shot at afterwards. Immediately after the bombing, they were getting shot at. I tend to believe the guys that were on the ground more than what the DOD report says. So I don't know what the motivation would be for the Department of Defense to make those claims, but it just seems like it's very inaccurate. And these troops that were on the ground there deserve a hell of a lot better, because they went through hell, they lost their friends, and then essentially the government lied about what happened. Big reason for me writing the book, you know, a lot of names have come out of, you know, a lot of heroes from those short weeks in Afghanistan, and they all deserve it. But there's also, you know, a lot of unnamed heroes that were there and saved a ton of lives, and their names haven't come out yet. So I'm just, you know, honored that I get to kind of introduce them to the world and tell their stories, because these stories need to be told. Because if they don't, they're going to get forgotten, lost in the DOD report that says it didn't happen. So it's up to us veterans. It's up to the guys that were there to share those stories and tell what those guys went through. Never been so proud to share the uniform than I was in those weeks. Zelensky he still has nightmares of this little girl with green eyes that came up to him and spoke perfect English and begged him to save her family. But they didn't have the paperwork that the State Department was requiring at the time. And I think, I hope I don't misstate this, but I think that after he had to turn them away, the State Department changed their mind and was accepting that paperwork that they had. So just, you know, again, the failures of the State Department for just lack of consistency. I know that one really haunts him. He says he still sees her, you know, green eyes in his sleep. Zelensky had a newborn baby, his first child, while he was at Abbey Gate. He's standing there and an Afghan mother comes up and hands him a dead baby. And she just turns around and walks away. And so he's standing there holding this dead baby before he ever holds his own baby. And that's, you know, one of a million things that these guys went through of just seeing horrible, horrible shit. Just the worst of humanity and the best. But I know that was very challenging for them. Not much has gotten better in terms of the evacuation. The SIV program is still completely broken. There's multiple bills going through the government right now. The Afghan Adjustment Act is one of them, essentially trying to create paths to citizenship for these people that we promised protection to. I don't know what the current numbers are, but I want to say there's still over 100,000 applicants in the pipeline that are still stuck in Afghanistan. A lot of them will get approval from USCIS by the time the embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan, where a lot of them are now getting out of, by the time they give approval, their USCIS approval has already expired. Essentially just red tape failure by our government to not properly help these people. But yeah, I mean, the Taliban's in full control of the country. There are some resistance efforts going on. The main one that I know about is the NRF, the National Resistance Front, which is led by a man named Commander Massoud. He is the son of the original Commander Massoud. The Lion of Panjshir was his nickname, the leader of the Northern Alliance. So back, you know, those horse soldiers that rode in to Mazar Sharif with the Northern Alliance, you know, that was the original Commander Massoud, who fought the Taliban for many years. And he was executed by the by Al-Qaeda the day before 9/11 because they realized that he was probably going to be, you know, the U.S.'s comrade in Afghanistan. So now his son has stood up and taken the leadership over of the National Resistance Front. I had the privilege to be able to go over to Austria and meet with Commander Massoud and some of the NRF and talk to him. I spent 3 days there with them. And what they told me was they currently have the ability to take over Kabul, but they don't have the resources to hold it. So they're not looking for any troops. They don't want any boots on the ground from us. All they want is financial support to be able to buy supplies and weapons and ammo. And they think that they would be able to take over the Taliban and take back Afghanistan for the people. I don't know enough to really give any more information than that as to how capable they would be of overthrowing the government. But that's what they claim. And as far as I know, they're the only ones really fighting the Taliban consistently right now. So, you know, hopefully our government has taken a hard look at that and trying to, you know, figure out a way to redeem ourselves a little bit and help these people that we promised protection to. Because every day right now, our Afghans are being found by the Taliban and being slaughtered. Their wives are getting raped in front of them. They're getting their heads cut off. They're getting thrown in trunks and tortured. You know, it's not hard for the Taliban to figure out who worked with us, right? There was a instance, I was trying to help a family. It was the family of a U.S. airman. The Taliban came into his family's city and, you know, essentially they grabbed somebody up and say, hey, I'm going to fucking kill you and your family if you don't tell me who worked with the Americans here. That's all I have to do. It's not that hard. And so they found out that this family had a son serving in the U.S. Air Force, went to their house, shot the shit out of it with AK-47 fire. I have all the pictures. Luckily, they weren't home. They got home, realized their house had been torn the hell up, took a bunch of pictures, and then they fled, and we put them in a safe house for, like, 2 years. They actually just made it to the U.S., like, a week or, like, last week after 2 years, you know? And I remember going through that process of trying to help them and thinking, like, oh, this is the family of a U.S. airman. Like, we're good. The government's going to take care of this real quick. You know, it took endless applications to get them in. Luckily, we partnered with Congressman Jim Jordan out of Ohio, who his staff was amazing as well, and they were able to expedite the visas, and we got them in last week. So they're here in Ohio safe, and I'm going to meet the family next week, so I'm pretty pumped and get a nice Afghan dinner too. So it's quite pathetic, honestly, that here we are 2 years later and we haven't fixed this problem to people that we promised protection to. When the U.S. government makes a promise to protect you, if you work with us, you need to uphold that promise and protect the people that need to be protected. Because the message, what does that say to our potential future allies? You know, what it says is that you're going to help us. You're going to put your life on the line for us, and that we're going to leave you behind. My book is called Life and Death at Abbey Gate. It's out now on Amazon, Barnes and Nobles, wherever you buy your books. For me, it was just like, I mean, multiple reasons. It was, like I said before, to be able to tell those untold stories of these Marines that were on the ground was an honor and a privilege. And I'm so glad that their stories will be able to come out a little bit. And I know it means a lot to them, just for like them to get it off their chest. I mean, you know, when I was interviewing some of these guys, like some of them were saying, like, I haven't even told this stuff to my wife. That, you know, they said it was just so good to be able to tell their story. It was also just very therapeutic for me, you know, to be able to get that off my mind. And, you know, I essentially like threw up on paper. You know, I just brain dumped the whole story. And then from there, you know, essentially spent 2 years just making it make sense in a way that a reader could get through it and process the information and really understand what happened there to be able to tell the stories of the heroes from Abbey Gate. You know, I hope people enjoy the book and they learn about what happened to these U.S. troops that served us in Afghanistan and served the Afghan people. And I hope that the U.S. government, you know, continues to push forward and pass legislation to allow a path to citizenship for our Afghan partners that stood by us for 20 long years of war.